Hello and welcome to the Cambridge Ukrainian Studies podcast, featuring discussions about Ukrainian culture and society with students, scholars, and artists around the world.
I'm Rory Finnan, director of the Cambridge Ukrainian Studies program. In this podcast, a discussion about Ukraine as an object of academic knowledge and state propaganda, taken from a recent conference, Ukraine and the Global Information War. The Ukrainian intellectual Mykola Rabchuk once described Ukraine as a country in between in all possible ways. And indeed, over the course of the past year, in the midst of uprising and war, Ukraine has been caught between a Russian propaganda machine highly active in television, print, and internet media, and a European public largely ignorant of its history and culture. Its own mediascape, moreover, has been caught between state-run and oligarch-owned outlets. This crisis in representation has had profound implications for the development of a coherent security policy in Europe and for the resolution of an armed conflict in Ukraine that has now claimed thousands of lives. A group of talented scholars address these issues in this podcast. Rachel Polonsky chairs a series of presentations by Andrei Portnov, Tatiana Ogarkova, and Tanya Zaharchenko, all of whom attend to the question of Ukraine as an object of academic knowledge and state propaganda in Germany, France, and Russia, respectively.
My name is Rory Finnan, and I'm director of the Ukrainian Studies program here at Cambridge and also head of the Department of Slavonic Studies. It's really wonderful to see you all here today. Of course, some familiar faces, a lot of new ones, and that's terrific. I wanted to give you a sense of the how of the conference, very briefly, as well as the why. As you know, over the past year, the words disinformation, propaganda, state deception have been used with great frequency in the public sphere with respect to the Maidan Revolution, what's been called the Revolution of Dignity in Ukraine, the invasion and annexation of Crimea, and the war in Donbass. And the very fact that we're often confused as to what kind of terms, in which terms to use to describe what is going on in Ukraine today, for instance, hybrid war, is it unconventional war, is it an armed conflict between states, is it an international or just simple armed conflict, And we don't really know what to call its actors either. There's a great diversity in practice here. Are they separatists? Are they terrorists? Are they pro-Russian, Russian, etc.? The discourse here, terminologically and conceptually, is really muddled and complex. So I think this is testament, actually, to how this informational conflict has been affecting all of us. So this conference is meant as a modest attempt to clear the air. These issues are too complex or too deeply rooted. And I would suggest deeply historical as well. We can't simply tackle them in three short panels. What we can do, though, is scratch the surface, connect members of this audience with the fantastic scholars, civic actors, and journalists that we have here gathered with us today. And one just general thing, two just brief points before I hand off to our chair, Rachel Polonsky. First, I really do hope that we can conduct ourselves today in a collegial and collaborative way. It's very easy, I think, to be discussing information more, to become part of it right away. And the extent we can be respectful to one another today, I would, of course, wish to see that. I hope we can do that today. The other thing I want to do is something actually very simple, but doesn't often happen in global public or academic discourse, and that is simply to place Ukraine as the setting for what's going on. It's often the case that we divide Ukraine between a pro-EU West and pro-Russian East. This, of course, divides the country, leaves it without a center. And if the past year has taught us anything, is that indeed Ukraine does have a center. It has a fully developed civil society, one we should be cognizant of, respectful of, and simply place Ukrainians in Ukraine as the subject of their own story. So with that, I'd like to welcome you just once again and hand off the microphone to my great colleague, Rachel Polonsky, who will be chairing this first panel.
Thank you very much, Rory. So the overarching theme of this first panel is the relationship between academic knowledge and, I'm not going to say disinformation, let's call it information, but to see how Ukraine has emerged as an object of academic knowledge and state propaganda, and how those two areas of knowledge touch each other. and I'm hoping for a very fruitful discussion. So to that end, I'm going to ask the speakers, each of them will make remarks, but not go beyond 15 or 20 minutes so that we can really have the discussion that this topic deserves. So our first speaker is going to be Andrei Portnov, who is currently based in Germany at the Institute for Advanced Study in Berlin, where he's a fellow and is also a visiting professor at Humboldt University. So, would you care to start our discussion today, Andrei?
Okay. I hope I try to use this place, the Norwich place, for a while. Good morning, dear friends. I'm a bit surprised, of course, to be the first speaker, but why not? So my task, as far as I understand this bit now, is to give you a very brief introduction, let's say input, into the issue of propaganda and academia in Germany. Please give me, could also tell me what about, let's say, Poland or Ukraine or Russia, but I'm really, let's say, limit myself to the German part of the story, mainly because of the, let's say, understanding of importance of Germany as a country, as a society, as an economy, and in present day European Union. And that is why I would dare to say, let's say, this media coverage, political debates about Ukraine, present day Germany, they have a crucial importance for the entire situation. So first and foremost, let's say the key issue here, and I'm very glad that Rory already mentioned it. And we said that the main problem in, let's say, German public discourse about Ukraine is that until now, quite often, Ukraine is portrayed, is analyzed, is perceived as just an object. As an object of, let's say, West Russia struggle over, you know, this zone of influence. As NATO and this Russian, Belarus, Kazakhstan integration projects, competition, so on. It's pretty difficult until now to find a kind of a concise discourse of Ukraine as a subject of this story. And the typical, let's say, mistakes of these interpretations in this context would be out in Zenomen, more or less. First and foremost is the idea of two Ukraines. Exactly, again, it's very similar. Quite often, I could tell it for sure, because now I'm giving some talks about position on political every week, and you always have questions like that. And what about the civil war between the Russians and the Ukrainians in Ukraine? And those notions, Russians and Ukrainians, they are used paradoxically. On the one hand, as a kind of an ethnic notion, but at the same time, as a language notion. So it's kind of like a trick. So you have this idea that Russian speaking in Ukraine means being Russian, and that means being pro-Putin. Pro-Russian politically, and vice versa. Ukrainian speaking means being pro-EU and at the same time nationalistic, which is funny as well, but it's like a self-assured and so. And let's say my task all the time to my students is to explain it's not so simple that the correlation between the language, the political loyalty, and let's say ethnic identity in Ukraine is much more complicated than like this primitive scheme, but it's not easy to do that. And now the question, like, why? So let me briefly give you my interpretation why it's like that. In my view, it's mostly because of the strengths of the, let's say, old-fashioned stereotypes about Eastern Europe, and they are very strong in German public discourse in German opinion. Despite all those talks about, you know, like getting rid of Nazi past and so. If you look, let's say, closely at the narrative, also in encyclopedias everywhere, we see that until now, Eastern Europe in general, but not Russia. Eastern Europe is Ukraine, Belarus, Poland, and so on, not Russia. So it's a zone of nationalism, anti-Semitism, a chaotic and difficult national tensions. And this region is supposed to need a kind of a strong hand, you know, to be ruled properly. And that is why it's really amazing, actually, how strong this partly unconscious perception is. I am speaking, let's say, in a provocative way to provoke discussion, of course. And then it also comes to a very interesting thing that this kind of attitude is also very much grounded in the German memory of the Second World War. Because in the German public perception until now, the Second World War was war in Russia, not in Ukraine, not in Poland, but war in Russia. Even in German, let's say, TV series, it's usually like war in Eastern Front is war in Russia. So a lot of Germans, especially when say left-wing, social democrat origin of the 60s, 70s, they still have this feeling of historical guilt towards Russia, but not Ukraine or Poland or Belarus, it's towards Russia. And this guilt, this emotional feeling, is perfectly used by Putin propaganda all the time. It's perfectly used in various aspects in German public debate. And if you listen to this strange interviews by ex-chancellor Helmut Schmidt, this typical illustration. It's this, let's say, post-war generation built for Russia, and we believe that actually there are some countries like Ukraine, like Belarus, we don't know who they are, as Schmidt put it, historians have doubts whether they exist historically or not, and they kind of an obstacle for good relations with our proper friend, with our big, good Russian friend. And this type of narrative we also find in Sherman's talks and a lot of so-called experts like Alexander Rahr and many, many other guys played by Kasparov. So it's a very difficult situation. And the second issue here is that Ukraine as a subject, not only as a subject, Ukraine lacks a recognizable, let's say, historical, cultural, or even, I would say, like political legitimization of narrative. Because if you ask, like, Ukraine is what? You know, in the time of Maidan, we could see it's Klitschko. It's Vitaly Klitschko and all this stuff like that. So it's very difficult to find any cultural, historical, political figure in Ukrainian history who would be recognizable for the Germans. So it seems like, you know, like a place where there is nothing to, you know, to look at. And in the case of Russia, of course, you have the incredible amount of people, from Catherine II to, you know, Brodsky, Chekhov, and whatsoever. And now, maybe my last point for the beginning, so I'm going to be very, let's say, short, is that this situation, when until now Ukraine is very much analyzed and seen through the Russian perspective, through the Russian lens, and all those strange and very dangerous conclusions about the ethnic conflict values. So it is very much the result of the, delicately speaking, poor state of Ukrainian studies in Germany. So let us don't forget that there are no, I must say, Ukrainian studies programs in Germany comparable to our Cambridge Ukrainian studies, not at all. There are only a few universities where you could learn Ukrainian, and they're not the biggest and the most, let's say, important ones. In Berlin, for instance, where I'm located now, I'm the only one to have one seminar per week about Ukraine. All the rest, all the Slavic studies, they're only Russian, partly Polish, partly Czech, partly Hungarian. So it's only me, you know. But when I go back to Ukraine, it would be nothing. And that is why it's not a surprise that German journalists don't know what they're talking about. In the best case, they know Russian. In the best case. In the worst case, they're just sent to Kiev or to, you know, Dnipropetrovsk or to Odessa to report on events. And when they write their stuff, I have a lot of friends, of course, around that. When they write their stuff, again, they have no idea, they have no knowledge about Ukrainian history, or literature, or culture. So when they are explaining for themselves and for the German publicity what's going on, they could not use a kind of historical argument. They couldn't, for instance, explain why this Ukrainian-Russian language coexistence in Ukraine is so specific. Because they have no idea about the history of Ukraine, about his Ukrainian literature, and so on. And in other words, on Monday and 2 days ago, I'm trying my best to convince our German friends and colleagues to start something like Ukrainian studies in Germany. It's very difficult, because they are even organizing discussions or workshops every week, but it's not about making a stable institution. There is a very strong opposition to the institutionalization of Ukrainian studies in Germany. And that is why I'm going to say, let us be realistic about this image. What we're going to do, maybe just add to this picture, is that despite all this that I've told you before, if you look at the German press those texts are mostly, let's say, more or less correct, at least when it comes to the current situation. But when it comes to, say, to the TV shows or to the, just talking to people who read the press, I have this strong feeling all the time that the main stereotypes, they are still very much present there. So the first stereotype, to Ukraine, like no subjectivity. The second stereotype, the lack of, let's say, Ukrainian subjectivity in the historical sense of this word. And third, very importantly, the lack of feeling that we, the Germans, are in some sense responsible for Ukraine. So the lack of consciousness that it was the Germans who occupied the entire Ukraine twice during the 20th century. They know that they occupied Russia, but they are very much surprised to know that they were twice, at first in 1918, after the First World War and the October Revolution, and then, of course, during the Second World War. So, in other words, Ukraine needs a kind of a strong, well-done, let's say, cultural and information policy in this respect, because if we compare, let's say, the media activity of the Russian embassy, and of the Consular Russian Federation in Ukraine, in Germany, in the city, of course, it's incomparable. On the Russian side, it's a strong, well-designed campaign based on German cultural stereotypes. It is not based on the Russian stereotypes, forget about it. It's based on German stereotypes about Eastern Europe. If you look at Ukraine, it's, you know, it's almost nothing. Thank you very much, and I'm very happy to discuss all those issues later.
And I'll start my overview of the relationship between the academic knowledge and media coverage of the situation in Ukraine with good news. As you know, France has not recognized the annexation of Crimea. As you know, France has implemented sanctions against Russia. And as you know, after a long discussion, France is not delivering missiles to Russia. So that's very good news. And surely enough, all this is due to the fact that the mainstream media on Ukraine are mostly pro-Ukrainian, like France 24, like ITV, like newspapers Le Monde, Libération, and some others. Media coverage of Maidan times and later on was correct. There were no problems, because journalists who went to Ukraine, they were open to reality, they were open to discussions, they were quite professional, they were sympathizing to Ukrainian experience, etc. But still, if you consider the situation more in detail, I would say that there are some observations to be made about the academic knowledge, about intellectual tradition in France, as well as some typically French reactions to media coverage. And my first point would be about the weakness of academic institutions and lack of visibility of academic structures which produce academic knowledge about Ukraine in France. In fact, the evidence is that there are quite few institutions focused on Ukrainian language, civilization, and history in France. In first place, I would mention the French Association in Ukrainian Studies, founded in 1992, and its president, former ambassador to Ukraine, Philippe Desurnon. This association published a lot of books on Ukrainian history and on Ukrainian literature, and also they're translating several Ukrainian writers. And after 2004, I would say that the interest to Ukraine is higher than before, after the Orange Revolution. This association also published electronic newspapers called Ukrainian Perspectives. Another important institution dealing with Ukrainian history and culture is INAI, National Institute of Oriental Languages and Civilizations. And the Ukrainian unit of it, the Ukrainian section, Irina Dmitrievna, she does a lot of good things in this direction. But the problem is that that's all, just two institutions, that's all. And Slavonic studies, just like in Germany, in 90% of cases, it's Russian studies. So the direct consequence of that is there is quite few real experts to be invited to TV shows, to be interviewed by French media. There are some good exceptions, like excellent people like Andy Tanguy, for example, like Yulia Shukan, excellent researcher, young researcher from University of Nanterre, in administration and some others. But these people, they do travel to Ukraine, they work with journalists, and they know what reality is. But my point is that there is no critical mass of such experts in Ukraine, unfortunately. And the weakness of this pro-Ukrainian, Ukrainian academic network simplifies the task for Russian propaganda in France. And my second point would be about the Russian presence in France. In France, there are approximately 300,000 of people of Russians living there, and these people are not only invited to TV sometimes, they're interviewed by newspapers, but they also have their own media. They have newspapers, they have internet sites, radio, and even TV channel in short time. For several examples, there is a site called Euro-Info, about 700,000 visitors in France. And this site is diffusing Russian propaganda. Radio is Radio Moscou, which also exists in internet under the name La Voix de la Russie, the voice of Russia, also the same. And the everyday newspaper Российская газета publishes in the French newspaper Le Figaro. Once a month, it published a kind of summary, kind of supplement in French language about Russian events and from the Russian point of view. And here we can see a lot of Russian propaganda as well. Last but not least, Russia Today, famous Russian propaganda TV channel, announced in August that they will launch a French version of their channel to broadcast in France. The consequence of that is that French people and French public opinion, they have a kind of an alternative source of information for them. And I would say that there is a demand for this alternative point of view, not only because there is a strong Russian community in France, but also because French people sometimes have pretty strange reactions to mainstream media. I call it a hipster mentality, when people, they mistrust their media, even if the media is professional. So in Russia we see that media are often lying and people trust them. In France, mainstream media tell the truth, but sometimes people don't trust them. So it's quite different. And still, and here I come to my third point, there is, independently from this Russian propaganda, there is an intellectual tradition which plays in favor of this Russian point of view situation. And there are two major factors for that. First one is this famous French anti-Americanism, which has strong academic, strong historical, I would say, background, because French intellectuals had mixed feelings about America since the very beginning, the conflict between old Europe and Europe. America in France is often perceived to be too liberal, to be too capitalistic, to lack social responsibility, etc. At the same time, America is often seen as a country capable of a military intervention anywhere in the world. And the consequence of that is that French people, sometimes, French public opinion, they think according to the following logic, the enemy of my enemy is my friend, and the enemy of the United States is Russia. As famous historian Tony Judd put it about 40s and 50s, that the majority of French writers, artists, teachers, etc., were not for Stalin, they were against Truman. They were not for labor camps, they were against colonialism. And now we can say that French intellectual community sometimes is not so much for Putin, but it is against Obama. And it plays an important role. So it means that they tend to view the situation and about Russian aggression as a response, as a reaction to American strategy of enlargement. Talking about NATO, for example, and French people have more sympathy for Russians because they see Russia as an alternative to this American, I would say, domination. As to the second factor which plays an important role, I call it anti-European factor, which also exists in France and which also has direct impact on how the situation about Ukraine is perceived. In France, there are several anti-European forces like extreme right political parties, Front National, also some extreme left people as well. Ethiopian for French people. The French people, they sometimes think that Europe is somewhere in Brussels. It's not something in France. It's not in Paris. But their system is European. Bureaucracy is European. And that's why the sequence of that is that just sometimes don't understand what Ukrainian Maidan is about. Because for Ukrainians, it's quite clear, Europe is a synonym of liberty, of dignity, of human rights, etc. And French people just don't understand what's going on. And in short, this anti-Americanism and this anti-European vector play in favor of what you call Russian point of view on the situation. And that is why intellectuals are quite divided. I've just mentioned several of them who supported Maidan, like, for example, Bernard-Henri Lévy, famous blogger, writer, essayist, who went to Kiev several times, spoke publicly in Maidan in favor of it. I would also mention Pascal Bruckner, famous writer, who came to Kiev also recently, and in his public speech he was very pro-Ukrainian, etc. Probably also Andrei Glucksmann, famous also intellectual. In the university circles, there are people who express publicly their opinion in the media, and an excellent example is Françoise Thon. She's professor at Sorbonne, and she published in Le Monde an article accusing the French government of being incapable to react to Russian aggression against Ukraine. But at the same time, though this intellectual supported Maidan and Ukrainian point of view, but at the same time, there are a lot of other intellectuals which defend the Russian point of view. And one of the most known in France is Jacques Sapir. He's an economist, director of research center at High School of Social Sciences. He's capable to ask questions, for example, can you prove that Russian troops entered Ukraine in August, for example? And his colleague, John Lodland, is a British journalist in the past who moved to Paris, and he wrote a book in 1997 about the undemocratic origins of the European idea. So this anti-European vector plays its role. And John Lowland founded Institute for Democracy and Cooperation, quite a strange thing, strange institution, like a think tank. He organizes events which are talking about all the situation in the Russian point of view. And his colleague in this Institute for Democracy and Cooperation is Natalia Narachnitska, Russian historian who has another NGO in Russia, and they published a very pro-Russian and propagandistic site called Staletie Ru. It's very aggressive Russian rhetoric and very aggressive propaganda. Well, to sum it all up, I would say that, first of all, weakness of academic structures which produce academic knowledge about Ukraine, presence of Russian propaganda in France, as well as some intellectual tradition like anti-Americanism, anti-European vector, it influences the fact that the vision of French vision of what's happening actually in Ukraine. Frankly speaking, I feel that French people don't see the situation like an existential challenge to them, to Europe and to France. During the last several weeks, French media talk much more about, I don't know, about illness of Ebola and about Islamic State. They talk much less about Ukraine because they don't think it's an existential problem for France. They don't fully realize, in my opinion, that what's happening in Ukraine it's not just a war for Donetsk and Lugansk, it's a war for Europe. And it's a war for France, and the Putin and his politics represent a real danger, not only for Ukraine, but also for Europe. Thank you very much.
To Russia for a one-year postdoc to study how Russian media portrays Ukrainians, in particular Russian-speaking Ukrainians, because that's such an easy point to manipulate, to say that Russians, as I've mentioned already, Russian speakers are ours and need defense and need protection. We've all seen this in media already in the announcement of President Putin. But because from the beginning of this one-year project now, what I would share with you are more observations rather than results, and I would love your advice and feedback. And my opinion is not endorsed by the Higher School of Economics. So, the more I'm studying communication theory in Russia today, the more I see the application, if I may ask, thank you so much, of something called the spiral of silence, which I'm sure many people have heard about here. It's an old concept. It dates back from 1974. It belongs to Elizabeth Noel Newman. And I think it is worth reviewing it and returning it now to our analysis. This concept analyzed how some groups remain silent while others remain vocal. So he measures the willingness to speak out versus the tendency to remain silent. And what this theory said when it was created and updated over the years is that we all have a sixth sense of what the majority thinks, what the public thinks. And because of our fear of social isolation or lack of sympathy or approval, we will adjust what we want to say according to our surroundings. And the reason I want to kind of work it in now into the Russian situation is that there's opinion, a public sense in Russia that is theoretically anti-Ukrainian, which is bringing this spiral of silence into motion. There are three conditions for the spiral of silence to occur. One is that the issue must have a moral component to it. We cannot really debate, well, we can't debate facts, obviously, in the current situation, but it must be moral. Let's bring in some fascism, some pogroms. There must be a time factor involved, which means that we as people must be able to evaluate which direction this opinion will go into and what is our position into it, this public opinion. And the third is mass media. Mass media must have an identifiable, a very clear position, and that's where I'm kind of working on. As scholars who wrote an article called 25 Years of the Spiral of Silence, a Conceptual Review, said the mass media play a large part in determining what the dominant opinion is, since our direct observation, especially in Russia, is limited to a small percentage of the population, and the mass media have an enormous impact on how public opinion is portrayed, not necessarily an honest reflection, but a portrayal of it, because they can impact an individual perception about where that public opinion lies, whether or not it's accurate is irrelevant. And what we're seeing, what I'm seeing now in the beginning of my review of Russian coverage, is three basic methods of portraying Ukraine. One is the creation of the myth that Ukraine equals chaos, mifologema. In Russian, you can choose several words to describe social uprising. You can use волнение, you can use беспорядки, you can use погромы. See if I may ask you to. President Putin has used pogromy repeatedly and extensively, and his media belongs to him, uses pogromy rather than волнение or even a revolution, because pogromy makes us feel very uncomfortable. The second is what journalists called creating frightening alternative. The frightening alternative to what we have now in Russia, maybe not perfect, but the alternative is fascism, and it's very frightening. It's pogromy, it's people killing each other for speaking Russian. We don't want that. Let's make that clear. And the third method is dehumanization. I think we all know what that means. It's when we portray atrocities that may or may not happen. One of them is the famous crucified little boy who never existed, which the Russian media rotated a lot. So these three things result in the wish of most Russians to not be there, there meaning Ukraine, which is really interesting because when I was reading Maidan coverage, it may have been severe, it may have been bloody, but the language used, especially in Ukraine, you may not want to be there actively, but you certainly want to be there in your mind because it's portrayed as a revolution of dignity, it's portrayed as a place where Ukrainians are making their future happen, versus this place where there's pogrom and crucified boys. You don't want to be there, so if you're not going to go and check what's happening in East Ukraine, you're never going to know whether the coverage is true or not. So your sense of public opinion and truth is kind of going into the spiral of silence that we saw before. There are three targets to this that can be identified, to this kind of propaganda. One is the Russians. What we, the government, want from the Russians is loyalty and a sense of external enemy. When the people are loyal to the government, they're less likely to disagree with its policies internally. In fact, there's the research that shows that Russians are now showing on service that they're more pleased with health coverage and education than they were before, because now there is more important things for us to be displeased about. The second target is Ukrainians, to disinformed inexperienced news consumers, particularly in the east, in the east of the country, to sow there some panic and kind of destabilize their sense of what's going on. And the third target is the rest of the world, where the aim is to discredit the revolution, the Maidan, and to discredit the new authorities, which makes cooperation with Ukraine even ever more difficult. One of the tricks used by such coverage is using words such as «понекотрендане», «предположительно», «есть информация». Does anybody not, do people not speak Russian? Are they not? So, thank you. Supposedly, according to some sources, there is some information, which is not, if you talk to journalists, they will tell you it's not a professional way to refer to your sources. An example would be an announcement on the website of a pro-Kremlin Life News. I'll just read one sentence in Russian. Напомним, по имеющейся информации, на проспект Победы в Симферополе приехали трое бойцов, предположительно из правого сектора, и расстреляли бойцов самообороны, прочее всего, после чего скрылись. Let us remind you that according to our information, to the prospect of victory in Simferopol came three armed people, supposedly from the right sector, the right. They shot people who were defending Simferopol and vanished. No sources. Предположительно. That's one of the language that is consistently used in Russian media today, which creates what journalists and communication theorists call the echo chamber. I can't say that word correctly. Thank you. A situation in which information, ideas, or beliefs are amplified or reinforced by transmission and repetition inside an enclosed system. And, you know, we'd be wrong to think that this is only possible in Russia. In 1995, a study came out on the US public opinion called The Spiral of Silence During the Persian Gulf, which found the same results that Americans assumed, that we didn't really mind the Persian Gulf, but in reality, each person had something to say against it. So the spiral of silence was spinning there. And another term to toss out there is something called the bandwagon effect, which we probably can all imagine what it is. As more people come to believe in something, others also hop on the bandwagon, regardless of the evidence. However, having given this kind of pessimistic coverage, if we look at this TV Rain, it's a good opposition channel kind of self-run announcement just from a few days ago. It says it's a study of the Mother Center in Russia and the Kiev International Institute of Sociology in August September 2014 that came up with the following results. 70% of people in Ukraine say there is a war between Ukraine and Russia. 74% in Russia say there isn't. And our reaction, of course, is just this is unbelievable. How can this be? This is such a big difference. But in reality, if we actually look at the questionnaire quoted here, the Levada Center, in reality we have 59% of people who say no. That's the circle there. 59% say no in Russia, whether or not there is a war. We have 15% that are unsure, which TV Rain summed up. And we have 26% of people who say yes, there is a war, which is every fourth person. You know, my bus to work, that's a quarter of a bus. And surprisingly, sociologists commenting on this, such as Volodymyr Panyota, who is the director of the Kiev International Institute of Sociology that ran this questionnaire, said that a quarter of Russians, let's not react immediately. A quarter is a lot. This is a lot of people thinking for themselves, given the information available to them. And this is more and more people whose opinion diverges from the government compared to, say, a year ago. So this is unexpected, but a good thing to hear and a good thing to think about, indeed, given this propaganda, given this tricks and this spiral of silence we just discussed, 26 is a good start. Not enough, but a good start. And if we go on a few more, this is a Russian media kind of against the background. Just a few more surveys to mention. Levada Center ran another questionnaire in which Russians said they don't want to return to Soviet-style media. 70% said that every newspaper should present its own version of events, and only 12% think that mass media need a unified voice at all. And the second questionnaire I wanted to mention, August 1914, again Levada, 58% responded yes to the question, do you need information about events in your country and in the world, and analysis of these events from sources of information whose position differs from the main channels in Russia? 58% said yes. Not a lot, but not horrible. And where I think we come in is, this is the last slide, so thank you. Where we come in to the situation of the percentages I've just mentioned that originally sound bad, but give us hope if we look into them, at least give me hope. That's the reason I stayed in Russia for this project, despite the dire kind of landscape in some places, is the fact that it looks, the opinion, the discussion is possible. This is a picture I took on the March for Peace in St. Petersburg this September. Of course, if I blogged about it, and if you go to this blog, you will see screaming people, kind of red-faced, upset people, but this was also possible. This is a pro-Ukrainian activist and a kind of pro... I don't like this use of this pro and anti. I'm not sure they're correct. This is the person who is with the St. George's ribbon, who feels that the pro-Ukrainian rhetoric, it could be, you know, could be leaning right too far. Let's put it that way. And they were discussing for a long time, and I loved watching that. If I may just, I'm finishing up. If I may get back to experience in academia. Do I have to?
Yes.
Okay. You know, I did my undergraduate studies in Bard College in America in 1999. When 9/11 happened, we were gathered as a whole college in our cafeteria. The president, senior tutor, the equivalents, all came up. They said, you guys, this happened. This is, let's discuss this. This is something horrible. And we discussed for hours. When I got to Russia this October and got to the Higher School of Economics, I looked around for places where students could do that kind of discussion, where they could ask, they could have questions. There's nothing in Russian academia in Ukraine. And when I say Russian, I'm talking about St. Petersburg, but I want to generalize, maybe colleagues in Moscow could mention an event on Ukraine, but I'm looking for an event where students can ask questions and it does not exist. Our country, let's say our Russia, right? Our country is at war, there are people being murdered on both sides, and our kids are not getting any answers. This was, I think, my biggest shock. And there are no events for staff or faculty either. And so perhaps what I would want to, we can discuss more things as this conference goes on, but what I was hoping to ask you to think about is, I would like, unendorsed by the Higher School of Economics, to put through such an event, because these kids will follow you around in the corridor, and they will say, can you please just, the literary told me, can you please tell us, why was the convoy, humanitarian convoy, so offensive? I just really want to know this. Why were you so upset? Wasn't it a gesture of kindness? And these are second year undergraduate history students. They need that information if they're going to want to be, if they want to go grow as historians and analysts. So I really hope this year while I'm there to run an event where these students can gather, where they can ask questions, whether on Skype, whether personally. So that's my email right there, and please, if there are any ideas or thoughts about it, how we can do this. If they're asking questions, if there's 28% of Russians, 26, who know there is a war, I think we need to reach out to them. Thank you.
This podcast is part of a larger public program of seminars, exhibitions, and festivals produced by Cambridge Ukrainian Studies, an initiative of the Department of Slavonic Studies at the University of Cambridge. Find out more of what we do at www.cambridgeukrainianstudies.org or find us on Facebook. Music provided by our friends, the Ukrainians.